Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Shoftim. I'm pleased to announce that we believe that we've solved the problems with our feed to iTunes, and so now the podcast should be listed correctly and downloaded correctly to you if you're using iTunes. I apologize on behalf of the podcast for the technical problems that we've had, and I'm glad that we have now been able to solve them. This week, Shoftim by Rabbi Daniel Landes. Rabbi Daniel Landes is the director of the Pardes Institute. And now, Rabbi Daniel Landes.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha, Shoftim. Well, let me tell you about a lecture I heard in my youth by Professor Salal Baron. Professor Baron was professor of Jewish history at Columbia University, I think, until around 1963. About 5-6 years later, heard a lecture from him, I believe. And one of the things he talked about was those factors that made it possible for Jews to be successful in business, international business, in the Middle Ages. As we know, Jews saw an opportunity there. The part of the opportunity came from the fact that they were restricted in many other businesses, but international trade was more or less open to them. He asked from the audience some ideas as well. What I remember him saying is that, of course, Jews were good at international business. The notion of capitalism almost was invented by Jews. Fungibility of money, fungibility of assets, but also personal connections. Jews were close to other Jews, were able to communicate to each other. It wasn't modern Hebrew, but they communicated very well. Kinship ties. But he said there was one factor that stands out in his mind, and that factor was that Jews who went into business from different countries could always adjudicate their claim, meaning that they had a problem with each other, and that often happens in business, I am told. They had problems with each other. They could go to a local court, a Jew from France and a Jew from Aleppo are in some sort of business combination to take spices and other precious items from India and to bring those wares in front of a fourth party or a fourth grouping, and they have a problem with each other. They could go in India, they could go in France, they could go any port of call in Germany. They could go to a local Beit Din, and they could adjudicate rapidly and fairly their claims. Furthermore, not only the rapidity of it being done, not only the fairness of it being done, was considered an absolute judgment, and not only was it an absolute judgment there within that country, it was an absolute judgment wherever Jews lived. Basically, the Jew from Paris couldn't go back home, didn't like the judgment, get another kind of judgment, go through another court. That didn't work. That court in India was considered to be, or the court in Germany, whatever, was considered to be an absolute court. This gave Jews the possibility of doing business without that constant fear that they're going to be stabbed in the back, that they're going to be sidelined, blindsided by their partner, gave them the ability to be even more forthright and more courageous, being able to take a risk because they knew at the end they're not going to have that problem. Have other problems, but they won't have that problem. And I say this introduction to this parasha because the glory of the Jewish people are not only the laws which it has created and the Decalogue symbolizing all the laws, but the very fact, and here by laws, I'm really thinking more of the social economic laws along with the ritual, but find the social economic laws, which have always been the majority of the laws talked about by the rabbis. The rituals have been very important, but they really don't come into conflict as much per se. Discussions, argumentation, different forms of interpretation, but they're not really personified by people. But when you go in front of a court and one guy says, well, I don't know, I think you owe me 200 rubles, and the other one says, no, actually, I think maybe it's only going to be 145 based on what we did. Those are not only theoretical principles. Those are personified, real-life, passionate situations. So our parsha, which deals with many laws, Shoftim, begins exactly that way, judges. Shoftim v'shotrim titen l'cha b'chol sha'arecha, asher adonai elohecha noten l'cha lishvatecha, v'shavtu et ha'am mishpat tzedek. Judges and officers, shotrim, enforcers, as it were, but not unlike police in our time, except that they also seemed in that period to do, not adjudication, but make sure things were flowing, make sure that the produce of one person was not blocking the produce of another in the local shops. In that sense, good police enforcement. So Shoftim v'Shotrim, judges and officers, titin l'chal b'chol sha'arecha, you should place in all of your gates, which the Lord your God will give you, lishvatecha, for your tribes. V'shavtu et ha'am mishpat tzedek, and the nation shall, and they shall judge the nation. They shall judge the nation, a mishpat tzedek, a worthy judgment, a righteous judgment is probably a better term. So let's talk about Shoftim. I talked a little bit about Shoftim, the police enforcers for the public good. Shoftim, according to Zal rabbinic interpretation, the Shofet really existed in two major terms, really three groups, but two groups I'll start with. The Shofet that will be b'chol sha'arecha in all your gates. The gates here mean the gates of the city. That's where actually where all the action took place. When you talk about the commercial, economic, and this continued in the rabbinic times, commercial, economic center of the city, the center of the city was actually, I'm putting in quotation mark center, was actually where the gates were. That's where everything took place. And judgments needed to take place there. Why? Because that's where the action was. That's where things could take place very, very quickly and where things could be resolved. Chol sha'arecha meant both for lishvatecha, for your tribes, that there should be the proper court for each tribe, but there should be a proper court for each city. So if one tribe had many large enough cities to warrant a court, to warrant a significant court, they would have a court of 23. And the court of 23, always do it, that case, was actually even able to do capital crimes. B'chol sha'arecha on all your gates, and including a court for the entire shevet, the entire tribe. If you had a very thinly populated shevet tribe, and maybe one city or two cities or whatever, so they wouldn't have that many courts, but there'd be enough courts because the courts would be in those major places. The court of 23, based on certain rabbinic derivations, was extraordinarily careful that in capital cases, which will allow for execution, that there would always have to be a majority of at least two in order to convict. To set one free, a majority of one was sufficient. The shavtu et ha'am mishpat tzedek, and they shall judge the nation a true judgment. They'd be very careful in their personal ethical and their ethical status, their way of being. That's how they needed to this is how they needed to proceed. The other court, of course, was the court of 70 or 71, which was the Great Sanhedrin. And the Great Sanhedrin met in Jerusalem, and that's responsibilities there were for taking care of the tribes, one tribe against the other. It's like one state or one province against the other. It would take care of august personalities such as the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. It used to judge the king, but that became eventually impossible. Kings just became too powerful, and that became a source of contention in the perfectionist system that we try to create, and that becomes a sore point in Jewish judicial history. And they take care of other things such as that are really national issues, including going out to war, the depraved city, Ir HaNidachat, and what to do with that. What to do with the Navi Sheker, the false prophet, or the Zakein Mamre, a member of the court or a member of one of the high courts who rules against the decisions of the Sanhedrin. What do you do with him? They take care of those kinds of issues. There's another court, and those are the Court of Three. The Court of Three is a court which is either kind of present in the marketplaces or is a pickup court. A pickup court meaning that both plaintiffs who want rapid adjudication will take people amongst their co-workers, co-owners, let's say, of other stores, if we use that as a model, people on the street, people that there's nothing wrong with them but are not necessarily very learned. But we hope that amongst the three, there's at least one who has a grasp of practical law and practical justice. And the three of them, if agreed upon by both parties, are actually fully trusted to give a proper judgment. There are differences between these ordinary persons, hedyotot. Hedyot, unfortunately, sounds too much like the word today, idiot, but it doesn't mean idiot in that sense. It means a common person. And a mumcha, a mumchim, which are people who are trained and understand. Gamir v'savir, they understand what needs to be done in any given situation. Of course, if you have three who are mumchim, or at least one who's a mumcha, one who's an expert, you're really in good shape. But it's a mumcha in many ways. Once the court is agreed upon, the court of three, by the individual plaintiffs, the agreed upon nature gives us rise to hope that they will give the right judgment. If they go against law and they cause irretrievable loss to an individual, those who have judged it, if they're not a mumcha, they're a hedyot, they take upon themselves the responsibility of paying back the injured person. That's a gross violation of law. The case of mumcha being an expert, has kind of an insurance policy in which he does not have to pay back. We assume that he has done his best and he's the best that could be taken, and there's a societal interest in keeping him there. This agreed upon nature of three would seem to perhaps only limit it to three, but not necessarily. It could mean that if the two plaintiffs agree that one person is sufficient, that would be enough, and they can agree upon that person, whoever they select. On the other side, when we get to the courts of 23, we're really looking for people who really are mumchim in the full sense, that they're really fully expert. And certainly that is true with the court of 70, even more so. And one of the questions in all this is, what power does these individual courts have? The power of the court of 70, of course, is to make absolute decisions. Court of 23 is in its locales to make absolute decisions as well, but also to summon to court. Does the court of three have that power? Well, If they are made up of mumchim, then they can also have summary power, and they have very strong power as well. When they're court of hedyotot, then they can't have that power. Of ordinary people, they don't have the power to summon. There has to be some sort of agreement how this will proceed. Therefore, it makes it rapid self-reliance, but there's a weakness that is kind of inherent to its ad hoc nature. Where do these courts take place? Well, the Sanhedrin is only in Jerusalem, and the Great Sanhedrin. The Little Sanhedrin, the Court of 23, which is also called Sanhedria Katana, the Little Sanhedrin is only in the gates of the individual cities. What about outside of Israel? And that first took place when the Jews had the Babylonian exile. What takes place? They're no longer there. Well, it becomes more difficult, and the effect of the law is that B'chol She'arecha still exists. In all the main cities, there was always a court, and the court became synonymous with the notion of the city itself. There is no city without. It's not just the city has to have a court. The Jewish population within the city has to have a court. But it's also that they really symbolize the Shoftut Am. They judge the people. They actually become synonymous with the Am, and the Beitin becomes the court becomes the people themselves. What power do they have? Well, this is became a difficult situation, first of exile, and later on when the tradition of giving smicha was cut through persecution. And a new concept arose, which I will end my talk here, shlichutayokov dinan. We are doing their shlichut, we're doing their agency. What does that mean? That means that courts that are outside of Israel, or courts even in Israel that are no longer made up of people that are considered mumchim, experts in the sense that they receive this direct generation from generation transmission of authority, the smicha, the metaphoric laying of hands. Laying of hands is only for Moshe, but the metaphoric laying of hands. When this became interrupted, and we needed courts, and we needed justice to be done, and we just couldn't give this up, and we had also left our land, the concept is shlichutayu. We are doing their shlichut, their agency. Concept in Jewish business law, and is found in Jewish ritual law, the shliach adam kamoto, that the agent of a person is that person. If I appoint Yossel as my agent, and I say, Yossel, go out and do business dealings on the market, Yossel has my checkbook and do whatever he wants. Of course, if I say, Yossel, you can only go up to $5,000, that's fine. But whatever restrictions I make, but within those restrictions or no restrictions, he can go as far. I say, Yossel, find me someone to marry. Yossel can create a marriage contract, and he can sign on it for me, the equivalent of getting the witnesses. He can do such things because shliach adam kamoto, the agent of the person is the person himself. So that has affected ritual law, for example. We have a shliach tzibur. We have the agent of the community who represents the entire tzibur, the community, the minyan together, and says important prayers. But it certainly is there in the judicial capacity as well, that when the judges who need to be learned and understanding, and they have to have chachma, and they have to have wisdom, when they do important cases, such as certainly status questions of conversion, of divorce, who gives them that power? Or they do really high-minded cases, high-impact cases. We no longer do capital cases. What do they do? What's their warrant? Shlichutayokov din. We are the shlichim. We are the messengers. We are the agents of those original courts. That gives a certain sense of dignity. It gives a sense of continuity, and it gives a sense of assurance. This glory of the Jewish people, shoftim v'shotrim, of having outstanding judges, learned, wise, and moral, and even in some cases having ordinary people in cases that need quickly and want to be resolved. This is something of terrific pride for the Jewish people. I wish you Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Landes. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.